It's another edition of the Shooting USA Podcast special coming from the Smith & Wesson Employee Shooting Sports Center, the IDPA Indoor Nationals. We've just fired last shots, and I've got Ravin Perry and Rob Tate here with me, guys. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
Thanks.
How did you find the match? I mean, everybody's talking about how technical this match is, difficult shots, a real test of the shooting. How'd it go for you, Ravin?
It was a rough match. They had a lot of technical things, low light, no light. A lot of tight shots. So there was it was the whole gamut of everything IDPA all wrapped into one, and that's what you expect when you come into, a top-level match like this. And let's just say that they gave you enough string to hang yourself by on every stage.
Right. Yeah. Rob, ESP or SSP?
SSP.
Okay. So Ravin, in theory, has a little bit of a equipment advantage over you, maybe.
Yeah, a little bit.
How did you find the match? How did it work for you?
The match is, ESP versus SSP, same round count, same capacities in the guns. SSP, ESP, these distances, not really that big of a deal. There was a lot of challenging stages, a lot of movers, a lot of time critical stages, where you have to get in a position, very position sensitive stuff. Tight shots, hard cover, non-threats, the whole lighting situation. I took more points down than what I normally would in an outdoor match. However, I'm hoping that everybody felt the same way at the end.
Right. Anything that stands out for either of you guys as being really difficult?
The partial lighting stages.
Yeah.
Because that was extremely position sensitive. If you had your gun, a couple inches further in the port, you couldn't see your sights at all. Mm-hmm. You had it, further back, and then you were perfect, and I figured that out afterwards.
The partial light is the more difficult stages. When it's completely dark, that going into it. You use your flashlight, what your sight picture looks like in complete darkness with the flashlight. And then the light stages, obviously, what that looks like. It's just like daylight. But whenever it gets in between the two, where sights start to fade and it's not quite dark enough to use the flashlight and not quite light enough not to use the flashlight, it's a big decision factor.
Sure. The one stage in particular that stood out for me as a unique challenge and one that I had not seen at an indoor nationals before was the shotgun wedding stage, the 16 targets, one shot on each, high emphasis on accuracy. And for you guys, that came at the absolute end of the match.
Right.
How did that work out?
That's always a difficult one. I've shot those same type of stages at other disciplines. But that's always a tough one to, because you're at the end of the day, you're just like, dude, I just want to get this over with. So you have to really stay mentally in it. I did pull a couple into the hardcover, so that was, I had a couple mess ups. I had some good setups, but just at the end of the day, you're just wanting to get over with it. That was a big game changer because, a lot of people were taking points down, a lot of people were taking failures. Just a shoot that, somewhat decent, it was a big thing.
Well, and also in IDPA, they have the failure to neutralize rule.
Sure.
So if you put a round outside of the down one and it only requires one round, it's, the down three, which is a second and a half, plus the five and a half.
Right.
A stage like that, and it's really hard, especially keyed up in the Nationals at the very end of the match, it's very hard to put yourself in a mindset, but in those stages, you really can't shoot those slow enough, because of the emphasis on accuracy.
Mm-hmm. I know you guys keep track of how each of you are doing as you go along in the match, and you kind of gauge where you are, but how closely do you watch the other guys in the squad in terms of their performances, and how does that, if it at all, does it dictate what you might do?
Well, for me, I'm not a big fan of watching other people shoot because I shoot different than, maybe Bob Vogel or Jerry Micklick.
Mm-hmm.
I have to always watch how I shoot my game. I my big background is, you know, USPSA. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a different style of shooting. So when I shoot IDPA, it's a different. I have a different mindset in doing things. So I may not be able to do the same things as, you know, other people can do. So I have to shoot it my way.
Sure.
You know, it all evens out at the end, but it's how you get there. You know, and just being able to do, you know, different things. You know, I may have a faster split, or I'll take points down where people, you know, shoot a little more conservative and, you know, maybe take less points down. Mm-hmm. So just a different style of shooting. So.
Sure.
Well, and see, you know, the big thing is whenever you get on a squad like the squad that we shot with today, you know, everybody shoots about the same speed. So it is helpful to watch, you know, the timing stages with a bunch of movers and you know, mm-hmm. different difficult targets, because you have to watch and see somebody else shoot and see, well, did they have enough time to do it that way?
Right.
You know, because everybody's going to find one little way to save a little bit of time. And if the plan works out, that's great. If it doesn't, then, you stay away from that idea.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, we watch each other shoot. You know, to be honest with you, we watch the times. We look at each other's score sheets. But that kind of, you know, for me, and I think Ravin's the same way, it kind of goes in your head and out immediately. You know, I couldn't tell you right now whether I beat him or he beat me. And we watch each other closer than everybody else. You know, when that stage is over, you put it away. Now,
sure.
When we get back to the hotel, we'll pull the sheets out. We'll add them all up and find it out.
Right. Both of you guys fly the colors for Team Range Log. Talk about that a little bit. What is RangeLog?
RangeLog is a online shot log software.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically everything that shooters have done for years and years, you know, in their journals with their reloading log and their practice logs and everything else. It's all wrapped up in one place on a website. So you can go to, you know, www.rangelog.com,
mm-hmm.
Sign up for a free account, try it for 30 days. But we have, you know, hundreds of practice drills. We have mobile apps for it, so you can go to the range, pull up a practice drill, you know, shoot that drill, log it into your phone, you know, score it on your phone. It automatically puts it into your account. And then it'll give you analytical progress reports on how your shooting's going from, you know, over periods of time. You know, so then you can also share that information with your buddies. So, you know, if you have a friend that shoots in California and you shoot in Virginia, you know, for example, we can both go to the range and shoot the same drills and online compare ourselves to each other. You know,
awesome.
So basically shoot a virtual training session.
Sure.
with your buddy.
Yeah, very cool. Ravin, I know you've turned some of your attention to the game of multi-gun.
Mm-hmm.
Rob, what other shooting sports do you participate in?
Actually, I shoot multi-gun as well.
Okay.
We both just qualified for the Three Gun Nation Pro Series this year.
Outstanding. So. And that leads me to my next question. What's next for you guys? You know, I mean, this pretty much kicks off the shooting season. What are you guys looking forward to? What's coming up next?
Well, this is next match is going to be the first Pro Series match out in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Have some USPSA matches coming up, have a couple IDPA matches coming up. I think Rob and I's focus this year is going to be mostly three gun.
Mm-hmm.
Just because we believe, you know, I mean, it's a huge growing sport, and it's just a heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah, multi-gun is definitely going to be it for the year this year. And we're going to focus primarily on the Three Gun Nation Pro Series style.
Sure.
Matches, but we're going to shoot a lot of the outlaw style three gun
mm-hmm.
matches as well. Yeah, you know, we'll fill the schedule where we can with USPSA and IDPA as well.
Sure.
But, you know, my next goal, and I'm pretty sure Ravin's as well, is, you know, the Rumble on the Range in Vegas.
Yeah.
In January.
That 50,000 is quite a draw, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What do you guys, just so that I know and maybe so the listeners can have a better idea, what do you guys do for a living? Are you pro shooters or what, you know, how does it work?
I'm a business development manager for Zeiss.
Okay.
And I'm also a partner in the company RangeLog.
Okay, great.
I work at a local BMW dealership as just a service advisor. Yeah, it's really, you know, real gun business, you know.
Awesome. Well, my wife just recently got out of a 335, so, you know, we're into a C-class now.
There you go.
Anyway, guys, thanks for the time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank Excellent. You guys for coming out and supporting all the sports.
We wouldn't miss it, man. And continuing the post-match coverage, I've got Bob Vogel. Bob, welcome to the welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Yeah, it's great to be here. This is sixth year in a row I made it here, and it's great.
Continuing the track record too, setting the pace.
Yeah. This was it's always the match to be at. I mean, it's one of the top three IDPA matches in the nation, and I'm always here. So,
this match in particular, I think this time was a little more technical. They threw in a little more. maybe accuracy-oriented?
Yeah. I mean, I shot on the, well, I could call it the super squad or whatever you will, but with most of the guys that have been here every year for quite a while. And
sure.
we all agree that this was a little bit tougher than at least the last few years.
Right.
For sure. Just, you know, very technical. And, yeah, it was a little tougher.
Anything that stood out as especially difficult for you this time?
I think anything that really stood out in particular. It's just there's a lot of – this is an indoor range, so – I guess I kind of understand they're a little more strict here with the rules, with, mm-hmm. you know, you can't go past this point, you've got to do this, you can't cross this line sort of thing. And it's understandable because, you know, if you touch a round off anywhere but straight down range, it's going to be an issue.
Sure.
So that's it just keeps you on edge a little bit more. But anything in particular, I mean, they had some fast movers. They had a lot of movers here. Yeah, you know, some of them were in the low light, you know, no light type of environment. And that always makes it tough because you really don't see that anywhere else at a major match.
Right. One stage in particular, the shotgun wedding stage, really put an emphasis on accuracy with the one scoring hit per target.
Right here. Yeah, was my second to last one, actually.
And that falls for you guys right at the end of the match.
Exactly. And that's kind of – guys are feeling the pressure a little bit more. You know, when you understand the scoring system, you realize that's a huge disaster factor stage. You throw one round, you know, outside of that down one area, you get that huge five-second penalty.
Right.
So, you know, you got to approach that. That was challenging. I just aimed. I aimed hard. I mean, I could have probably shot that a couple seconds faster and been fine, but I just take no risk and call every shot.
Right.
I mean, probably half of our squad, which is all master class shooters and probably even just the best of the master class shooters here,
sure.
Almost half of our squad seem to have at least one fair to neutralize there. And that's, you don't see that at too many stages.
So. Right. How much, if at all, are you paying attention to what the other guys in the squad are doing?
I was actually more so today. I usually keep track of everybody. I just like that. I'm always about the scores and everything. When you shoot at that higher level, especially when you shoot other places like USPSA, if you're not comfortable with that, then they'll tell you the scores.
Sure.
So, you know, some people, I don't want to know the score. I was like that earlier on. But then when you get to that level, you shoot certain guys, and they'll try to kind of mess with your mind a little
bit.
So I'm an opinion that you need to know that. So I was keeping track. You know, I had a very rough start. So it was like I was 10 points down, 10 seconds off just from the very start. So I'm like, wow, you know, sweating it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was paying attention a little bit more.
You're one of those guys that we see at the top level of all the sports, USPSA, we see it at Pro-Am, we see it at Steel. How difficult is it for you to adapt to the rules specific to IDPA?
I think that's what's taken me the longest time. I mean, I shoot IDPA, then I shoot USPSA/IPSC, and then I will shoot Pro-Am as well. But and I've been doing both for probably 11 years now. Mm-hmm. I've been shooting 12 years. I think 10 years I've been shooting. I think that took me 3 or 4 years to really get to where I can strap on this gear and it just automatically puts my brain in this mode and I can follow these rules. Because
right.
It is very different. The shooting skill itself is similar, but it's different. So,
right.
And that's what I see as challenging for a lot of people. It's so much, you know, just mental,
right.
Most of it.
Now, you diehard Glock shooter. You're getting some help from Taren Butler and TTI. Did they do any work on the gun you used here in the match?
Yeah, a little bit. He's got the logo on the slide, and he's done some of my trigger. I did some of it myself.
Right.
I just like it a certain way. He does great work, and I would recommend sending, you know, any Glock, anybody that doesn't really know what they're doing, that's not going to do it themselves. I mean, I would definitely recommend that because I've got quite a few of his guns.
Sure.
So he does a few things. I do a few things, but I just get it just how I like it.
There's not too terribly much you can do in stock service pistol, though.
No, there's not really. I mean, internal-wise, trigger-wise, you can pretty much do anything you want. You just can't have any external modifications. You can't go all out with the stippling and all that. And
right.
I've always shot a fairly stock gun anyway, so that's why I like to shoot stock.
Fantastic. Now, you're a big proponent, and you're actually one of the guys who led me into grip strength training.
Yeah.
And we talked about that at National Outdoor, and I started there. And I saw a noted improvement this year with how I was able to handle my ESR, 45,
okay.
Based on the improvements I've made in my grip strength.
Okay.
Where are you in grip strength training? Do you feel like you've reached a point where you're at a good plateau?
Pretty much, yeah. I really got after 2008, after the world shoot in 2008 is when I really kind of discovered that. And I didn't realize the whole strength issue. I mean, it's not an issue of exercising a lot. The issue is maximum strength. You do not get maximum strength unless you are working, you know, maximum.
Right.
So it's just like bench pressing 300 pounds. You know, you could if you're going to train for that, you're not going to train by doing 100 pounds a bunch of times. You're going to train by doing as much as you can. It's the same thing with grip strength. So once I discovered that, and used the Captain's Crush grippers and just trained really heavy, I saw my strength go through the roof because those things are measurable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I don't advocate overgripping the gun. A lot of people, you know, say, oh, you don't overgrip the gun. You don't overgrip the gun. But say you use 70% or whatever that optimal level is, the stronger you are, the stronger 70%
right.
is.
Right.
But then that means the less the gun moves, all else equal, the less the gun moves, the better you're going to shoot, the more accurate you're going to shoot. I mean, it's as simple as that. I don't care who you are. You can't really refute that.
Right.
So I just started seeing dropping points in matches. I mean, I'd shot some major matches where I dropped 8, 10, or 12 points the whole match. I never did that. And it just, you know, changed from year to year. And I'm a definitely big proponent of that, especially shooting a stock gun. Shoot a Glock. It's a light gun anyways. It's got some recoil to it. And you really need to control that gun more so than maybe if you're shooting a 40-some ounce, you know, 1911 or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But I'm a big believer in it.
Yep, and I'm finding that it's working for me, too. Even at my level, at my skill level, I'm seeing an improvement.
Well, that's good.
And I believe it's based directly to that. And it's one of those things, you know, everybody always talks about how strong Jerry's hands are.
Yeah.
Jerry's, how do you get those hands? Well, you know, when I first met you, I thought, this guy's got a crusher of a grip. Where's this guy getting this crushing grip? Well, you train for it.
Yeah, and that's the biggest thing I tell them. When I train, I mean, I train, and it doesn't take long. It's just the intensity. It's not how long you do it. It's the intensity. But when I'm done, I mean, it physically hurts my hands. I mean, it almost makes me cry sometimes
right. How
much it hurts to the point where I have to pry my fingers open. And if you can go to that intensity, you will get another level up on the guy that just, I'm going to do 10 reps, you know, and quit.
It's interesting because since I've started into it, and you and I have talked at great length about it, I ask other people, other top-level shooters, do you or don't you? And many don't.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, because I was already on that level as the world shooter, and I'd won the nationals and things like that. But I just noticed it gave me that extra edge.
Right.
So, and I guess I consider myself a student of the art. I mean, that's the first and foremost thing for me since I was a kid. I wanted to be a good shooter. I didn't care about, you know, maybe making a lot of money or shooting a particular gun or all that. So I wanted to be the best shooter I could be. So any possible thing I could do, I tried.
Yeah.
It was just that philosophy. If it's going to help me, it all give me a little edge, I'll try. And that was just one of those things I discovered along the way.
Well, I think to that point that you've just made, there had been a lot of talk about maybe now that you're not a police officer full-time anymore, signing a contract with a gun company.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, to the point that you're not in this to make a bunch of money.
Yeah.
You still don't have a factory sponsorship.
Yeah, I don't. And I could probably sit here and talk about that for an hour. There's a lot of reasons for that. And I'm good with where I'm at. I've got, you know, 3 or 4 sponsors I'm really getting some real stuff from. And I do a lot of training classes.
Okay.
The thing is, signing on with like a major gun company, I like Glock. I mean, I like the guns. That's what I'm going to say. I don't know the company, and that's a whole other story, and the way they do things, I don't know. But I do like the gun, and I've shot all the guns out there extensively, and I just feel that I perform the best with them. Because I didn't always shoot them. I used to shoot 1911, you shoot an STI for 3 years, and I end up making the switch. That's been 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and I discovered that, and it worked for me. I'm not saying it's going to work for everybody. So I owe it to myself when I go out there as a shooter that has trained my whole life to try to be the best that I can be, to shoot what I feel I shoot the best.
Right.
And at this point, I guess if it came down to the point where it made the difference of me shooting or not shooting, then maybe I would, you know, I don't know. But that's kind of where we're at.
I think you're fortunate to not be in that position.
Yeah, I'm kind of hardcore like that. And I like the freedom of where I'm at right now. I mean, I do a lot of stuff on my own. I can kind of make my own schedule.
Good.
I was a police officer. You know, I wasn't like I was walking away from a job where I made a killing, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit easier for me to make that decision, you know, 8 months ago.
Good stuff. I know before we got together for the podcast, you took some time to add up the scores. How do you feel about your performance?
Well, it's you know, remains to be seen, but I think I have it, according to the guys we talked about. Again, like I said, I gave away 10 seconds right off the bat, and we added them up, and I think it was 154. I think Brandon is second or 166. So I think I may have the high overall. Again, that's totally unofficial. I haven't seen anybody else. But every match that I shoot, I don't care what it is, especially IDPA, I say to myself at the end of the match and even after every stage, how much did I leave out there?
Mm-hmm.
How much better could I have shot that match? And when I shoot a really good match, you might, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 seconds out there. This match, I probably left 15 to 20 seconds out there.
Wow.
I mean, if I'd have shot this match to my ability, not perfect, you see, but
to
my ability, a good match, I'd have been 15 to 20 seconds better on this match. So That's how I judge. Now, how that relates to everybody else, I don't know.
You have also a track record of being the most accurate shooter in the match. There was a time when you were only down 6 for the entire match, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, well, I think it was here. I don't know. I've done much better than maybe about 15 or 16. But yeah. I was down 29 here, and I had a no shoot, and I also had a procedural, and I had the one miss as well. So not, you know, definitely not one of my better days. But a lot of that depends on the match.
But I think, again, this is a very technical, oriented match, difficult shots, and I think everybody else is going to face those same challenges, and I think it'll apply across the board.
Yeah, so. I think it probably will. Like I say, I shot on our squad, and there was nobody that escaped without at least one or two pretty bad stages.
Sure.
You know, and I obviously had those as well. So,
outstanding stuff. Thanks for the time.
All right, yeah, thanks for having me.
Good job.
You bet. Thanks.
Back with more from the After Action Report from the 2013 Smith & Wesson IDPA Indoor Nationals. And now I've got Jerry Miklich. Jerry, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
A lot of people are talking about how technically difficult, technically challenging this particular Indoor Nationals was. How did you find it?
Well, I approach IDPA in a different fashion than I would any other competition. So I listen really hard on what I'm going to do. I pay a lot of attention to the ROs. When you come to an IDPA match, you have to cleanse yourself of everything.
Right.
So you listen exactly what they say. If you come in with a preconceived notion of how you want to do something, you're behind the curve already.
Mm-hmm.
So you just go there and you listen and you execute what they tell you to do. And just take it in steps. You have to use cover. You have to reload where you want to, where they tell you to. And so it's a totally different approach as far as any other competitions you're going to shoot.
You and I had just spent some time at your range in December, and I reaped a great deal of benefit coming into this match, spending that time there, working on dressing up my sights, and not so much able to work on really the reloads. My reloads are way off par, but I found myself really concentrating on some of the things that you were teaching in the pro tips. How much of that are you applying, or is that just something that is ingrained in you now?
No, it's when I kind of look at a stage, the shooting is such a vision-oriented game that you have to approach it on the angle of what can I see here? Is the lighting really bad? Do I have to stay on the sight just a hundredth of a second longer per shot, or am I going to really have to look at the gun sooner, bringing it into the target, or is it a shadow here? Is it a shadow there? You really have to think about lighting and the way it affects you as an individual. Usually, when low light, you'll shoot high because you want to see the sight, and then the muzzle comes up. So most of your misses will always be high. Something you want to think about on headshots, especially in low light, because there's not much head box there. So it's just it's always the fine points that'll make a stage or break it. So just really want to pay attention to what the pitfalls are. If it's worth tricking out, or is it worth just shooting it clean and let the other guy die for his country, and just survive the moment. So
there were some tricky ones here in this particular match, though. I mean, anything stand out for you as especially difficult this time?
Well, the bowling alley stage. I forgot to put my shooting glasses on.
And then they just strobe lights and lasers. And
so it was we were running really ahead of schedule when we got over there. It was about an hour and a half backlog, so we took a break, and I did mention to another fellow competitor, make sure you remind me to put these glasses on.
Oh, wow.
And sure enough, I forgot. Got really involved in the stage and how to shoot it well, and when they put the lights out and said go, it was some of the best point shooting I've ever done in my life. But it wasn't enough hits, but that's one of the small things that will bite you. It's one of the things you have to keep going over on your equipment checklist. Where is this? Where is this? What is this? It's just one of the things that'll jump up and bite you when you think you know what you're doing.
It's a bit of a routine, and as soon as you fall out of that routine, things get lost, things get misplaced.
Yep.
You don't end up on the stage with the glasses on. So,
yep, so
were you able to survive it?
I had to eat 20 seconds with the penalty.
Man.
So I doubled my score on it with penalties, but I shot everything else really good. So I think it's still going to be a winner.
Good.
So, that's what you have to realize here, too. You don't have to burn anything down to win the match. You just have to stay consistent and let the other guy die for his country.
Well, I know I've asked you on a number of occasions and a number of different matches, hey, are you paying attention to so-and-so, or what's it like for you shooting with this guy, or how's it going with that? And you always, without fail, tell me, I just shoot my points. I just shoot my match. I know for a fact that applies here.
Right. What I'm kind of listening for is how well the pistol guys are running it.
Mm-hmm.
I know shot split wise, I can stay there with them, of course, on a reload. So I just kind of listen for the cadence of the stage and just try to make it sound the same.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I'm in the real realm of where I'm going to be. But other than that, it's still, you know, you got to take every shot as its own and every stage as its own. That's what you have to do with IDPA, especially. Like I said earlier, every stage is its own game.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go from ground zero and build it before you shoot it.
Well, I know a stage where you have set the pace here was the ambulance stage where the back doors swing open mm-hmm. the ambulance. And, you know, the fastest pistol shooters were 10 and change, a little less maybe. And you managed to go low 9. And, you know, so as I pass that information around to the others, like, well, it's because he's got a revolver. He didn't have to rack the slide. Well, okay, you know. All right, if that's how you want to see it. But fantastic performance there. I won't be surprised if that's not a stage win.
It might be. I changed my strategy on that right before I shot it. I was going to try to shoot the swinging target twice. But when I got there, the lighting really wasn't good like we talked about earlier.
Sure, sure.
And what was really distracting for me as a competitor, when I shot the first moving target, I actually saw the bullet go through the target zone right in the A box.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, when you see that, that usually means that you're looking over the gun.
Mm-hmm.
You're not calling your shots well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an indication that I was a little bit point shooting. Mm-hmm. I really didn't want to do a point shoot there because it's such a high-value target. And I did it on the other side.
Yep.
So it was I was in and out of control there visually, but I got the job done.
Your squad started the match on bays 1 and 2, and a lot of people have talked about the difficulty of bay 2, the shotgun wedding, one shot on each target, 16
right.
targets. How did that particular course of fire fall into your game?
Well, that's one of those deals there, guys, where you have to totally reprogram. You cannot come in here with an idea.
Mm-hmm.
You have to totally break it down. You have to go, okay, this is 1 and 1.
Yep.
You have to go 1 and 1. This is not what I want to do. This is what the stage mandates. And you can shoot twice, but you're just burning the clock.
Right.
So you have to reprogram. You have to have that ability to get up there and say, okay, 1-1, carry these two, shoot 1-1, shoot that swinging target, come up, do a reload, carry the 4.
Yep.
And on that third, on all those last 8 targets, there were 3 of them together, and it looks like the one in the middle is a no-shoot again, but it's a shoot target.
Mm-hmm.
It had the borders on it. Very yep. distracting target.
Yep.
A very simple target,
mm-hmm.
but it's also distracting, especially if you wear a corrective lens, where you have a sight and focus and the target really blurry.
Right.
And you kind of lose reality of what you're looking at. So you have to have that walkthrough down to where you know what you have to do and just go through it shot by shot.
There were some real pitfalls in that particular stage because a shot in a down 3, and if it's the right. only shot on the paper, that's an FTN,
yep.
and that is a killer in this game.
You had to be able to call your shots. That was my first stage, and I was a little bit hairy on the trigger. I was slapping at it a little bit on the first couple of targets and got in and out on the first 6 rounds, where it was a little bit rough, but then I really made myself pay attention and read the shots so I wouldn't have to go back and look.
Fantastic. I mean, do you practice for this? Do you gear up for this match? How many other IDPAs do you shoot?
I just shoot 3 of them, the 2 qualifiers and then the nationals. So I just shoot three a year. I did about 30 rounds of night fire and shot the standards a couple of times prepping for this, and that was about it. So
Good stuff. Well, that's everything I've got for you. Thanks for sitting down with me,
Jack. You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Continuing the After Action podcast from the 2013 Smith & Wesson IDPA Indoor Nationals, and I've got Chief Warrant Officer Chad Barber from the U.S. Coast Guard. Chad, welcome.
Hello, John.
Hello. You are the man responsible for one of the most notorious stages in this match, Stage 2, the shotgun wedding. Tell me about it. Tell me about conceptually coming up with that particular stage.
Conceptually, got to blame my wife for that one.
Yeah?
Straight up. She is the inspiration for a lot of the conceptions. I come up with the designs, and we make it work. It's a team effort. And it's not just her. I've got a full-fledged team of petty officers and young men and women that come in here, and we roundtable a lot of ideas, and we put it together.
Well, you had 2 pretty complicated, pretty demanding stages, and your bays ran absolutely flawless. And I know all of the credit goes to all of the guys from the Coast Guard who come out here and make sure this thing happens.
We're an academy that teaches leadership and planning and preparedness, and that's what we do. The Beehive right now is buzzing as you turn around and look in the range right now. what's happening. It's being tore down. The match is over and complete. Yeah. Everybody's shaking hands, high-fiving, smiling.
Clean it up, and it's going to be done here shortly.
They started 14 minutes ago, and it's gone. It took us 4 days to build it, and it's going away.
That's fantastic. How much goes into it? I mean, it takes you 4 days to put it up, but then there's more than that because these guys have been on site here since Wednesday running the thing.
It's months.
Yeah.
It's months of paper drawings, testing things out, talking about it, looking at different angles, coming up with different ways, though, because when a match is built, you have to design it to a sharpshooter level because that's the core of IDPA. You don't want to make it so complicated that they just blow it, they get frustrated. But at the same token, you've got to be able to challenge the masters, or not really challenge them, but make them think. Mm-hmm. You know, they approach a stage in a certain way, and they just blow through it, and it's no challenge for them because they're masters. That's what they are. But every now and then, you've got to really just design a way to make a path for a master to take a risk. What's the master going to do? What's the novice going to do? Mm-hmm. And make sure safety is paramount in keys. You don't want to put SO, safety officer, traps in there. And, you know, you want to keep everything flowing. But match flow is critical, too. If you get overcomplicated in design, the bigger the mousetrap, the more failures, you can wipe yourself out. But these young men and women, they get in there, and they have the same energy at 0700 as they do 1800 and as we provided this week. I mean, we were out here at, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock before we wrapped it up. So it was incredible.
Yeah, well, fantastic stuff, man. And, again, you're building on your legacy here. This is a special match.
Legacy.
You have a legacy. You have – your team has taken the marquee stages of this match for the last, what, 5 years?
Four years? Yep. But we were invited in 2009 was my first match out here. I had just met some folks in 2008 when I was stationed at the Coast Guard Academy. I moved up from Charleston, South Carolina, got here. And we ran a couple state matches. And this was my first sanctioned match. And the guy handed me a timer, says, you're running. And I'm like, huh? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was a lot of confidence in them that they gave it to me. And next year he came up and said, Chad, we'd like you to do this. Can you give us some designs and ideas? And we ran with it, and it ran really, really well. And then, of course, Frank Glover, who's the, you know, top of the heap when it comes to, you know, match directors and things like that for IDPA, he said, all right, we're going to do it again next year. And I was the only guy that got to submit stage designs and have my designs in that next match. And that was an incredible honor. And people were coming up. I had no idea, you know, but it was an incredible honor when it was all over. I was like, whoa. And then the following year, he used one of my stage designs in the, you know, premier match that everybody talks about, the Carolina Cup. And that was like, that blew me away. Yep. So.
Well, there you go. I mean, there's something to it. Now, this is a special one for you.
That's a special one for me because we don't know if we're going to be doing it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's I get transferred next year, and just the demands of being a military family, things like that on my family, I've got to look at them. And there's, like I said, months and months of planning. And I'm due to rotate, and we'll see what happens, and only God knows. So I'll just go with that.
Well, yeah, you leave behind the next level of what it should look like.
Well, at the same time, though, every year I put out 3 to 5 seniors that graduate that have been through my program for 4 years. When they come in here the first year, they sit and watch. They get qualified. They're shooters. And in my second year, I require them to be a safety officer. I'm a safety officer instructor for IDPA. We put them through our program. We train them up. We get them on the timers right away. So now they're running the timer for 3 years. Mm-hmm. They're sitting at that table looking at match designs, what will work, what won't work, where the traps are, how to increase the challenge for a sharpshooter. And then what happens is they go out in the fleet when they graduate, and now they're out in, you know, Texas or Michigan, or they're stationed down south in Florida where there's great IDPA clubs. And now I've got a young 22, 23-year-old safety officer with national-level match experience. Mm-hmm. And they're helping their local clubs out there. And these men and women join the Coast Guard to serve. Mm-hmm. So not only is serving the country, now they're serving their communities. They're serving their sport. So it's pretty impressive. It's pretty incredible. I love it.
But I think in addition to that, we witnessed another reason to do this today, and that is integrity. We witnessed it on the range today. One of the competitors had not been administered a – It was some sort of a procedural. He had addressed targets in the wrong order. Remind me of how that worked out. But regardless, the guy essentially told the range officer, I need a procedural because I did this.
Oh, yeah. That was a great example, though, of a master-level person coming up and saying, hey, it was a shooter-induced error. Mm-hmm. Guys, boom. You know, and I've got a young E6 on the timer and the scorekeeper right there. And they learned right away, you know, hey, this is what we did. This is what we expect of a master. We expect it of a novice. But we've also got to teach our young safety officers and scorekeepers to identify that stuff. But it's just really, it's a classic example of the integrity and the character of the people in this sport. You know, yeah, if you earned it, you earned it. Nobody wants to win by default here. You know, whether it be a stage getting chucked out or not getting a call, or right. somebody missed a, hey, you know what? I know I got a hit on a non-threat, but the scorekeeper put a hash mark down on the wrong side.
Right.
There's a lot of integrity in this match, and that's something you don't find in a lot of other sports, and I really enjoy what we see here. And, you know, being able to transition this now into a leadership example, whether it be planning for the approval memos for our command for these young men and women to participate, that's training for them now. Now they learn how to do the proper memo. They learn how to plan stuff, logistics. You know, here we are. How are we going to load up the cadets in the van? How are we going to move guns? Yep. It's an incredible leadership example all the way through. It's not just a sport of shooting. I can take this in right into a leadership example from freshman to senior, and now they're out there running, you know, a boat of their own with 16 men under their charge.
Fantastic. Can't get better than that. You've done a great thing, sir.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining me on the podcast. Well, that's it for this edition of the Shooting USA Podcast special from the 2013 IDPA Indoor Nationals at the Smith & Wesson Employee Shooting Center. Look for this and all of the other things you expect from the Shooting USA crew in a future show. Until next time, keep them in the tent range.